Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello there, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as usual, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain.
Well, that's a great way to start this podcast. As usual, if you know the source of the quote, please feel free to drop by Facebook or Twitter and let us know.
Yeah, I thought that one was appropriate because the discussion we're going to have does play somewhat into the realm of artificial intelligence.
Somewhat.
We're going to talk about technology and its effect on our noggins, specifically gray matter, that brain that's sloshing around in that cranium of yours.
Yeah, this has been a topic of some debate recently, probably, I guess, more over the past year, thanks to our not really good friend, but someone we follow closely, Nicholas Carr.
Yeah.
He's a technology writer.
He wrote an interesting article for The Atlantic back in 2008, and it was titled, Is Google Making Us Stupid?
Wow, is it that long ago?
Yeah, it was 2008.
Wow.
July, August 2008 edition. I've got it up right now.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. No,
I was just going to say, he wrote this article, Is Google Making Us Stupid? And it was an interesting, just an interesting take on technology, the way we consume information, and the way we think.
Yes. And he actually followed that up with a much longer format, a whole book called The Shallows, which some people have taken issue with the title, suggesting he's already decided that we're all stupid. But I'm not so certain that he actually meant it that way.
Yeah, that sounds to me like the sort of criticism one might make before fully reading a book. you know, one of those things where it's just your initial reaction to a title, and then you.
Sure.
Yeah. So let me give you a little story here, Chris.
Yes.
All right. Now, when I was going to school, the internet was not really something I had access to all the way up until the point where I got into college. Really, my sophomore year in college was when I was starting to really get access to the internet.
Okay. I can relate to that.
So up to that point, I studied just the normal way. You would attend classes, you would read study notes and read books and that sort of thing, and that's how you would gain knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, today, I work for a company where I write articles and blog posts and do podcasts where I have to research various topics, new ones each week. I'm doing so using the internet. Meanwhile, I also am tapped into various communication tools such as Instant Messenger, email. I've got text messaging on my phone when it works. We're recording this on the day that my Android phone died. Anyway, normally I have access to multiple means of communication, and this would presumably give me access to amounts of information I never would have had access to before,
mm-hmm.
right? A huge, deep, broad scope of information.
Yes.
However, despite this amazing ability to tap into lots of information, I find that it is much more difficult to concentrate on a single task for any length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have decided that technology is to blame and it is ruining my brain. Now, what could possibly be wrong with this argument?
Well, I would say that you're using anecdotal evidence.
That's a good point. Yes. I am speaking from my own experience. I have not conducted any deep study of this, mainly because I can't concentrate on that task for long enough to do it. It is anecdotal. That does not mean that the information is wrong.
No.
Right?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. So this is something that I wanted to address early in this podcast, because this is really going to be an interesting philosophical discussion. It's not just technology. It's really philosophy. And part of that philosophy is that anecdotal evidence is not really good evidence to base an argument off of.
True.
But that does not mean that it is invalid. It just means that, you know, there are better ways to support your argument.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've read quite a bit of agreement with Mr. Carr's work, and I've also read quite a bit of disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the disagreement I have read suggests that they all think, he's either afraid of technology or that he's basing it on his own anecdotal evidence, which I think the anecdotal evidence sort of started him down the path. But in The Shallows, he does explain in a number of studies that have been done on the attention span of people who are using technology for work. And therefore, you know, I am inclined to say that he's not, I'm not necessarily agreeing with his arguments in both the article and the book, I would say that, there is at least a kernel of truth in it, that it can be very difficult for some people to manage the flow of information coming to them from multiple sources, especially the internet, where there are so many different kinds of sources to choose from.
Yeah, and going further than that, Carr makes his argument in his article, and I'm mm-hmm. sure in the book as well, but he makes his argument that reading and the way we consume information shapes the way we think. So the argument here is that there are two different ways you can think about thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's the method where you say our brains are structured in such a way that thinking is a process that is going to be the same no matter how you consume your information.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just a device in a way. We're just reducing it in complexity to call it a device. It's a device that can accept information and then process it, and then we act on that information in some way.
Mm-hmm.
The other argument is that the brain is a very elastic, flexible organ that will generate different ways of thinking based upon the stimuli that it encounters.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that argument makes a lot of sense because one of the sources that Carr cites in his article is Marianne Wolfe's Proust and the Squid, which is a book about reading and learning.
Yes.
And Marianne Wolfe argues that humans are not born with the ability to read.
True.
It's not an innate ability that we possess, unlike, say, vision or hearing, where we can interpret the information in the world around us using those sensory organs. That's something that's innate. That unless you have some sort of disability or disease or whatever, or some other form of impediment to those senses, you can. That's one way you can gather information and learn about your environment.
Mm-hmm.
Reading is a skill that we had to invent and develop over time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's relatively recent. It's just a couple thousand years old. And that through reading, we changed the way we thought. So the developing reading was a skill that we had to learn. Through reading, we changed the way we learn.
Mm-hmm.
We could preserve information unlike we could before. Like before, it was all folklore, right? You passed it down by explaining to people what you knew, and then they would take the words you said and they would apply it so that they would understand the concept, and then they would have to pass it on. But there was no easy way to share that information. It meant that knowledge was kept in small pools across the human race.
Mm-hmm.
Writing allowed us to keep that information in a locked format so that future generations could benefit from it.
Right. It could be fixed in some way for, perhaps hundreds of years.
Yeah.
So that people could read an original account, or at least a particular account of an event, or, to tell a story.
Now, Carr says, actually has a very interesting little passage where he talks about how Socrates bemoaned the development of writing,
mm-hmm.
because he thought that by writing things down, you did two things. One, you reduced a person's ability to actually take in information, understand it, comprehend it, and then build on it.
Okay.
Right? Because now it's in a concrete format. And two, he was afraid that it would give people a false sense of knowledge. That because there was a written thing down, there was a written format of this information, that would make people feel like they knew more than they did. The knowledge was written down. It wasn't necessarily in the person's head.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was worried that people would become less wise over time because they would be relying upon this written information. They wouldn't really understand it. They would just think they did.
Hence Carr's argument.
Exactly. Carr takes that to a further extent.
Mm-hmm. Now, like many, many people, I've read David Allen's Getting Things Done,
mm-hmm.
because there are just so many things I have to do in a day, a typical day here at HowStuffWorks.com and my own personal stuff, that I wanted to improve my productivity. And one of the things that that Allen argues is that it is stressful to try to remember all the things that you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things he says that is important for you to do is to write something down as soon as it occurs to you. So that you have it written down, that you know you need to do it. You don't have to remember it anymore. You need to put it in some sort of system. Now, it could be a piece of paper. It could be a smartphone. It could be whatever. It doesn't matter what the medium is in this case. But you need to write it down some way. And that sort of plays into, Socrates/Carr's argument, because if you're documenting everything, you don't have to remember it anymore. For Allen, that is a sense of relief. You don't have to remember it anymore. You can take a deep breath and relax, knowing that you're going to remember to do this thing because you've written it down.
Right.
On the other hand, however, you have the other argument that, well, you don't have to remember it anymore. So you're not training your brain to remember all the things that you have to do, and you don't have to focus on it.
Yeah, you're not making connections. That's another thing that Marianne Wolfe mentions in her book, is that the brain makes actual neuron connections, kind of like circuits, really.
Sure.
For concepts. And you can start to connect seemingly unrelated concepts in your brain just by thinking about it, concentrating on it. It's not just that, you know, you encounter information and now you know it. It's that you encounter information, you think about it, mm-hmm. you actually take the time to consider it, and you start building connections from other information you've gathered previously, and you form new knowledge based on that. It's similar to a process, a philosophy known as contemplative learning.
Mm-hmm.
In contemplative learning, the goal is to actually take time to consider the information that you have just encountered mm-hmm. and to incorporate that into your body of knowledge, not just to say, oh, I encountered this fact, but to really have a deeper understanding of what that fact means, what's its relevance, its context, that sort of thing. It's sort of an element of critical thinking, mm-hmm. but it's a particular way to get to critical thinking. It also, depending on how much you read about contemplative learning, it can start sounding a little touchy-feely.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of elements of meditation in there, and there's a lot of tie-ins between contemplative learning and spirituality, things that someone who may be more skeptical might find a little questionable.
Right.
All right. But the idea here is that you are allowing these connections to be made. You're not just encountering information, reacting, and then discarding.
Right.
Which is that's kind of what Carr's argument is.
Mm-hmm.
That the way we encounter information now on the web, we will look for some relevant facts for whatever it is we're searching on. And if we don't see it pretty quickly, we'll bounce to another source, right?
Yes.
And we may never go back to that first source ever again.
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned that study by the Hans Bredo Institute in Germany several times on the podcast now,
mm-hmm.
In which they had studied what some people call the web generation. Another group in Britain had done this, and I scrolled past the name of it. The Center for Information Behavior and the Evolution of Research.
Oh, Cyber.
Cyber at the University College London. Both did similar studies on young people who were sort of expected to know how to use all the ins and outs of the internet
because
they grew up with it.
Yeah, they were born after the internet went public.
Yes, I studied this in my in pursuit of my Master of Science in Information Sciences degree because I was looking at in the way people seek information, and those studies both back up Carr in that regard, in that people tend to look for information on the internet. Now, this doesn't have anything to do with whether or not it's making you more or less intelligent.
Right.
It's the way people seek information on the internet, and they do. They skim from site to site. They hop around a lot. Very few people spend a lot of time on websites when they are seeking information on a particular topic.
Yeah.
I should point out too that the people who have been demonizing Carr for making these arguments, he says, look, no, I'm a writer. I absolutely need the internet. The internet has completely revolutionized the way I search for information,
mm-hmm.
and it's awesome and it's brilliant. It just seems to be, anecdotally, it seems to be changing the way I think, you know.
Which may not be a bad thing.
No.
Changing the way we think. This has been the history of technology and ways of recording information. It's just one of those things where we do start to adapt the way we think. It's mm-hmm. something that's really unavoidable. I mean, unless you become a Luddite and you decide that you're going to go and adopt Socrates' manner and try and gain information that way. And even then, it's just on an individual basis. You're not going to stop the way the world is going. The study that you were referring to, the cyber study,
mm-hmm.
Let me read exactly what their finding was. It was called, they called it horizontal information seeking.
Mm-hmm.
This is a form of skimming activity where people view just one or two pages from an academic site and then bounce out, perhaps never to return.
Mm-hmm.
The figures are instructive. Around 60% of e-journal users view no more than three pages, and a majority, up to 65%, never return.
Mm-hmm.
So the suggestion there is that people are able to find information, but they may not necessarily comprehend it fully. So it becomes sort of like our brains become filters,
mm-hmm.
right? We start filtering out anything that's not relevant to whatever it is we're searching,
mm-hmm.
and we sort of pinpoint anything that is relevant.
Right.
And then even Carr will mention and also Clive Thompson of Wired, who wrote about this as well. He had an interesting article about the, let's see, what has he called it? Your outboard brain knows all was the title of his article. And he's written about the subject multiple times as well. He writes about how he uses various things like the email and Wikipedia and other internet sites to rely on information so that he no longer retains it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that he thinks of it as a richer thinking experience, that he can add really valuable information in arguments and discussions by linking to it. So it almost becomes like, oh, I know I saw this, I found this information, it's relevant to this discussion, here you go.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really, that's incredibly different from understanding, retaining, and being able to articulate information. It just means that you're really good at searching.
Yeah.
But that might be what the new definition of intelligence is. It may not be that it's rotting our brains. You know, we kind of jokingly titled the podcast that.
Yeah.
But that it's changing the focus of how we think. Instead of thinking in one way, we're now becoming really good at seeking out and pulling up information.
Mm-hmm.
Although that also takes practice, because the studies showed that students weren't necessarily innately gifted with that ability.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was an article called and of course Carr's title has been echoed in other titles, so this is going to sound very familiar. An article titled "Does Google Make Us Stupid?" by Jana Quitney Anderson from Elon University and Lee Rainey from the Pew Internet and American Life Project. They actually had referred to a rebuttal from Jaime Cascio. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, who is an affiliate at the Institute for the Future and a senior fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. And in response to that, they had spoken with Nicholas Carr, who said, you know, clarified a little bit more to say the answer to our question, the question we pose in our podcast title is no. It's not about whether your IQ is dropping. Your intelligence quotient has nothing to do with this. It's whether or not people are becoming utilitarian thinkers. Cascio quoted neurophysiologist William Calvin, who basically said that was referring to an ancient volcanic incident that humanity learned from in order to survive, and basically the argument in that article, which is really really awesome, and also on the Atlantic, basically is, look, this is a new way of thinking. We'll adapt to it, and we're going to have to adapt to it if we're going to survive, because there's so much going on now, so many different kinds of events. Technology has advanced to the point where we are going to have to think differently, and we'll just have to get used to what he calls fluid intelligence. Actually, scientists call it fluid intelligence, which is the ability to find meaning in confusion and to solve new problems, is the quote there. Basically, it's not memorizing or reciting facts, it's to sort of think on your feet, if you will. And basically his argument is, no, you know, it may seem a little weird, it may seem a little funky and possibly even scary to some people to have to think in this new paradigm, but we'll learn, and it will be able to use our brains and this new technology. We just have to get used to it.
And we've kind of addressed this sort of in our podcast about how to conduct research online. Mm-hmm. It's kind of talking about how to use this tool in the most effective way. And critical thinking is still very important, even in this new paradigm of thinking. It's just that critical thinking, the definition of it may have to be tweaked.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than sitting there and saying, all right, well, you have to really consider this information, it might be you have to be able to evaluate things like the source, its validity, its relevance. You may have to be able to do that on a very tight schedule. You may have to do it quickly, because there's so much out there that you have to be able to separate the good from the bad quickly, or else you're just overwhelmed with information, some of which may not be very valuable. Go ahead.
I was going to say that Carr points out that the internet can be a very interruptive medium, too.
Yes.
That you know, if you have alerts turned on, if you're a Mac user and you have Growl turned on, or if you're using Windows and have Outlook open and you have the little windows popping up, for example, here at work, or throwing around story ideas, and everyone else starts joining in, all of a sudden you have new alerts popping up on your desktop every 5 or 6 minutes.
Or more frequently,
depending on how often you turn it on. So perhaps you're working.
And how many jokes are being thrown in there.
True. But yeah, if you're working on a project and you have these constant interruptions from IM and Twitter and your email, they may distract you, depending on the way you're thinking. They may distract you from what it is that you're working on. And that can be disruptive, especially for somebody who's used to thinking in a very linear fashion.
Yeah, that actually brings us to another study I wanted to mention in passing, at least.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
The Psychonomic Bulletin and Review article, Supertaskers, Profiles in Extraordinary Multitasking Ability. And this was a study by Jason M. Watson and David L. Strayer. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to see, you know, people are getting accustomed to having to multitask.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But most of us aren't very good at it.
No.
He wanted to kind of see exactly how well people could deal with handling more than one task at a time. It also ties into the statement about how using a cell phone while driving is equivalent to driving while under the influence of alcohol.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Or actually worse than driving under the influence of alcohol, depending upon the study.
Mm-hmm.
So what he did was, he and Strayer, actually, they took 200 subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So small sample size, we should go ahead and say
sure,
that.
Yeah.
You know, 200 subjects.
Scientific, but could be more scientific.
Right. You're not scientific enough. But they took 200 subjects and they gave them tasks where they had to juggle multiple tasks at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They found that all but 2.5% of the subjects performed poorly when having to do multiple tasks at once.
Yes.
So, they could still perform the tasks, but they couldn't do it with the level of proficiency they could if they were concentrating on just one task at a time.
Mm-hmm.
2.5% of those people could handle it without any demonstrative reduction in their abilities. So they were apparently able to do multiple tasks just as well as if they were concentrating on a single one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
This 2.5% were called super taskers. Now, the interesting thing is that most of us think we're super taskers, even if we aren't.
Yes.
That was another element of the study, is that people who thought that they were really, really good at this, there were way more people who thought they were really good at it than the actual people who were.
Right.
Like, you only had 2.5% who were good at it, but almost everyone thought they were in mm-hmm. that 2.5%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may be that the supertasking phenomenon is something that will grow over time. It may be that we as a species will adapt to this multitasking demand, and that future generations will actually be supertaskers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, currently, it doesn't look like that's the case. It looks like most of us aren't supertaskers. But it may be that that's part of this process of the way we change our thinking, that future generations of humans will actually be very adept at supertasking. And of course, then there's also another science fiction-y kind of argument where you could say, yeah, or the singularity will take care of it.
Yeah.
Because we'll all have, you know, 64 core processors in our heads, and we'll be able to handle 64 distinct processes at the same time without any reduction in proficiency.
That would be really useful. I wouldn't mind having that.
Yeah, I wouldn't either, except my phone just died, and I can only imagine what would happen if the processor in my brain died.
Yeah, that could be problematic.
But that kind of ties into this whole technology rotting your brain thing. Again, we should go so far as to say it's not the technology that's doing this.
No, it's not technology's fault at all.
Yeah, so we do not hate technology. We aren't afraid of technology. Chris and I both embrace technology. We work for a technology company.
Yes.
We each have our own gadgets that are hooked into various networks. It's just that it's the process of having to deal with so many different lines of communication when we're not used to that. That's mm-hmm. not how we've trained our brains over the last hundreds of generations, really.
Yeah.
And it's that that, you know, we had to develop new skills in order to consume information. There's so much information out there that you had to do it if you weren't wanted to have a meaningful experience.
Right, right. And I think, too, the thing to keep in mind for both people on both sides of this argument is it's all going to depend on the individual. Some people process information differently from the way other people process information. And, you know, it's safe to say that someone like Nicholas Carr spoke with many of the other writers that he knows and said, you know, look, it's hard for me to focus on reading a book when I've been spending my time with the internet because I've been immersing myself in a very short message, very immediate message type of thing. And then I sit down with a book and it's difficult for me to concentrate because I keep wondering what's going on the internet.
Yeah.
And for them, that may be the case, but it may not be for some of the people who are saying, well, you know, you guys are crazy. That's absolutely not the way we think. You're just, you know, afraid of technology and you honestly don't know how to manage it. And you need to find a technology that you can use to manage your other technologies. and maybe that's true.
Yeah. It's hard to say.
One person, but maybe not for the other.
But so, you can say at least that there seems to be some relevance to his argument in the sense that old media adopts new ways of presenting information that are similar to the way new media does.
Well, Marshall McLuhan pointed that out long before the internet became something for people to consider.
It's sure.
The medium is the message. You can't separate that the actual medium it comes to you in is also part of the message itself, and
right.
That you can't separate them completely from one another. That's why an ebook is different from a paper book.
Well, it also shows how old media has tried to adapt by doing things like you may look at a magazine and you see
sure.
that there are a lot of little boxes that have an excerpt from that very article that you're reading.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you were to read the full article and then read the little box, you would realize, hey, this is just a quote that comes right from the article. But that's
a pull quote.
Yeah, it's an attempt to give relevant information in a very quick, efficient way for people who that's how they consume information.
It's also a good way to fill 2 inches if you can't find a shop ad.
Okay, but I'm trying to say here is that the internet has kind of trained us all to consume information that way.
Sure.
Where we're looking for the relevant facts as quickly as possible, and everything else is kind of in the way. And that's sort of how this old media is kind of adopting mm-hmm. it too. They're like, well, you know what? If we don't play that game, no one's going to buy the magazine, so mm-hmm. let's do it this way. And I wanted to kind of talk a little bit, just sort of closing out.
Sure.
There are two different concepts I wanted to get across to our audience. One is epistemology.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the philosophy of knowledge and how we gain knowledge and what knowledge is.
Yeah.
That's sort of guided a lot of this discussion.
Yeah.
Because there is a difference between information and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can
yes.
encounter information, be able to recite information. It doesn't mean you know it. Not necessarily anyway, depending on how you define know, really, because again, this is philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fascinating subject. If you're interested in this, I would recommend looking into epistemology and some of the writers who are really known for their work in that field of philosophy. The other is cognitive science,
mm-hmm.
which again is sort of how we learn and what processes are important in the way we learn. And it's just one sort of branch of science that kind of tackles that. And again, it has a lot to do with psychology. It has a lot to do with various forms of imparting information or absorbing information. That's also really interesting to me. So those two different fields are something I would recommend listeners look into if they find this topic really fascinating.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then I apologize for the last 30 minutes.
But I don't think there is, other than the literal answer, no. Technology is not rotting our brains, at least it doesn't appear to be at this point. I haven't seen any studies that suggest that, and even Nicholas Carr said, that's not what I meant. But yeah, I mean, it's something that I think we're going to have to do a lot of thinking about because the internet is still very new to many of us. And you know, even those of us who have, like me, who have had, you know, 20 years of experience using the internet, you know, I still don't think that's long enough to really grasp how it's going to affect how we learn and how we think, how we deliver information. So I think this is the kind of thing that's going to require more study before we really understand what's going on. And then it'll all change and we'll have to study that.
That would really be fascinating if we could just get a quick glimpse 100 years in the future and just see what society is like and what You know, what's the concept of learning at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, by then, maybe we're just doing the Matrix thing and just downloading information directly to our brains.
Yeah, that looked painful, though, with that thing that's shooting in the back of your head.
Yeah.
Ow.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not for everyone.
No. No.
I'm just saying. There is no spoon. Yeah. So, well, that wraps up this discussion. If you guys have any questions or comments, if you want to let us know what you think, you can follow us on Twitter or join our Facebook group. You'll find both of those under the handle of TechStuffHSW. Or you can email us, because we know you guys love to do that. We would love to be able to respond to all of you, but man, it's getting hard. The address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, and Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
If you're a Tech Stuff fan, be sure to check us out on Twitter. TechStuffHSW is our handle, and you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TechStuffHSW.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the new TechStuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.